We're just saying goodbye to Alan Gresick, and I'm welcoming my old colleague, once a newspaper man, always a newspaper man. It's like being a Marine, I think. John Ziemek has written a remarkable book, Collision On, and I've checked this. I've gone online now, which is really stupid for me, because I'm thinking, I know how to pronounce this. Is it Tenerife or Tenerife?
I say Tenerife.
It's a remarkable story, John. It's about the worst civil aviation disaster in the history of flying. How can a story like this, John, and one of the points of your book, how can a story like this be buried by history's dust?
It has been kind of lost to over time. I think possibly the fact that it was so far away, the
Canary
Islands. Remote island, and the Canary Islands, not even the main island.
Right.
There was, at the time, 1977, there was almost no electronic media coverage of it.
Yeah, we didn't have this 24-hour-a-day thing. And
that
I think,
exist.
You know, we're now sitting in the wake of the legendary, tragic crash of the DC-10 at
right.
O'Hare. 40 years ago, which I'm not sure, now that I'm thinking about it, it got a lot of coverage here, but I'm not sure it was covered nationally at all.
Yeah, might not have been. Although we do tend to pay attention these days to the really big numbers.
Well, this is as big a number as it gets, isn't it?
I've come to believe there'll never be a bigger crash.
I think there are a number of hopeful things in the book, especially how many people, survivors, dealt with this whole thing. But another hopeful thing is that this crash was the result of, and you piece this together in such detailed fashion, of it's like a million things had to go wrong for these two planes to collide, didn't they?
Yeah. I counted 11 different coincidences, mistakes, oversights that all had to fall into place perfectly in order for this accident to happen. It wasn't a matter of a mechanical failure.
Right.
It wasn't a software failure, as we've seen twice in the last 6 months with the 737 MAX. This was a series of human mistakes, misunderstandings, and one that was not controllable, which was fog.
Well, the other thing was neither of these planes. The other thing that's haunting about this book, Collision On, as John and I both pronounce it now, Tenerife, right? Is that good? I like Tenerife. I did a thing like pronunciation on the phone, and I got like five different voices telling me five different things.
Tenerife is a little more exotic, I guess.
Yeah. Tenerife, no, but it's Tenerife, T-E-N-E-R-I-F-E. This book is 35 years in the making, and you came upon it by meeting a couple that survived the tragedy. Did you meet them? What wasn't quite clear to me, Carolyn and Warren Hopkins, did you just meet them walking around Evanston, or did they approach you as a... When you were a professor, you were also an active freelance writer, as I recall.
I was, yes.
Did they approach you, or how did you come together with the Hopkins?
I met the Hopkins couple through a mutual acquaintance, just someone who said, who I knew, who was another writer, had his own projects going on, and said, "Hey, I've met a couple at an event, and they are looking for a writer." Caroline had written a detailed diary of
right.
her experiences and her and her husband's experiences at this through this horrible event, but they wanted a professional writer to help them make their story public.
When you first met with them, and I've done this a number of times too, when you first met with them, they seemed to me from the book to be good, decent people, not trying to capitalize at all on what had happened to them, unlike many people who want books written about, you know, there's a great book on how I got my wisdom teeth taken out or something. You know what I mean.
Right.
What was your first impression of them? Because you have to go in a little, you know, with your you know, journalist glasses on and think, why do you want... Maybe the first question you asked was, why do you want a book and why do you think this would be a book?
It was like that because Caroline and Warren were not particularly outgoing or let's make $1 million. It was nothing like that.
Yeah.
They felt what they had gone through was unique, which we would all agree with.
No question.
But they also felt there were things to be said that could be of interest to those who have not gone through what they had gone through. Warren, for example, was probably, according to my research, and I did spend years on this.
Well, you did. It's more than 30 years on this book.
I did.
Yeah.
I did. There were parts of those years when I wasn't actively
working. Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying every day you were locked in your basement transcribing interviews or something.
No. No, Warren was apparently the very first person to react to the emergency that suddenly became reality
right
after the two planes collided on the runway on Tenerife. And there was a lesson in him being that alert, and he got Caroline to respond, and then some other people saw the two of them responding. Besides the narrative of the story, which I do think is intricate and unusual,
well, and you should take great pride in too. The detail in this narrative is astonishing to me. I know you had to sort of any recreated conversations before the tragedy took place are based on interviews you did, the recreation is unbelievably detailed, and you must have. I mean, at one point, you must have said to yourself, "Oh, yeah, I don't need this intense detail." But then you kept digging, and you got it.
Yeah,
that must have been.
It actually was stressful to write it.
I'll bet.
I'll bet. My 7 or 8 rewrites, whatever the number was, it was right around there. Every single time I got to where the two planes are on the runway and they don't know, I had the cockpit transcripts of what the two pilots and their crews were saying to each other and the air traffic controllers. Every single time I got to that point of the narrative, I would tense up, I would get stressed about it because I knew what was about to happen, and I couldn't make them.
Well, what makes this, and I know it is based on a terrible, terrible tragedy where a lot of lives were lost, but it also is this kind of, it's kind of a thrill, in its way, John, and I, with all due respect to everybody involved, it's kind of a thrilling read, I think. I'm going to read two quick paragraphs to try to give you a taste of the kind of detail in here, the fraction of a second detail. The steering yoke jiggled uncertainly. The plane tilted slightly to the right, then the left. Van Zanten fed the engines all the power he could. Maybe, just maybe, they would get over the Pan Am jet. Why was it there? At 5:06.49 and 3/100ths of a second, Canary Islands time, KLM Royal Dutch Airlines Flight 4805 and Pan Am Flight 1736, carrying a combined total of 644 passengers and crew, collided and destroyed each other. I'm not saying that only writers can appreciate the amount of research and detail and craft in those two paragraphs, but it's immense. And I'm sure you said you went through 7 or 8 drafts of this thing. When did you decide that the Hopkins, it must have been beyond hearing just their story that made you say, Okay, Mr. and Mrs. Hopkins, I will try to put this together. And why did you think to first put it together as a magazine article?
No, I wanted right away, and I thought it could be bigger than that, so we were moving ahead in that direction. We started out with the idea of something like an as-told-to,
mm-hmm.
But I, you know, I was 10 years a newspaper reporter before this, and I thought, I want to talk to some more people. So I started calling other survivors. I started calling aviation officials.
This is did the Hopkinses put you in touch? Because there has to be a sort of like a survivors, and you talk to a lot of them, survivors network involved in this, because you live through that kind of thing. You share this tragic cord. Did they make introductions, or did you go at this?
They did, because some of the survivors had no interest in talking about
I'm sure of that.
Yeah, but when I said I was working with Warren and Caroline Hopkins, that did open some doors, and so we were able to, you know, move ahead that way. But the more people I talked to, the more I thought, I think we could aim for a larger perspective on this project, and not just a Warren and Caroline, although they are the center
they are, no
of
question.
The narrative.
No question.
But I did want to add other stories. There were a few survivors who said, oh, no, I'm writing my own book, and they would not talk.
And
but
did
but
any
most
of,
people were pretty helpful.
Did any of those people, as far as you know, write their own book?
One gentleman did write his own book. It was a self-published book. Then another man who was still alive came out with his own book about 2 years ago. In fact, his photos are in my book. He was very generous about letting me use the photos. He had a camera around his neck when he got out of the plane and realized as he was standing 100 yards away, oh, wait a minute, I've still got my camera, and took a few photos, which are now in the book.
You do such a... I'm not going to read a great deal of it, because I think you people out there listening should be reading this collision on Tenerife, the how and why of the world's worst aviation disaster. The author, John, J-O-N, Ziomek, Z-I-O-M-E-K, with special material by Carolyn Hopkins. You capture... so well near the end of the book, after the very detailed middle meat of the book, how Carolyn and Warren came back to O'Hare after this whole thing, and the sort of hoopla that surrounded them when they came back. But then, tragically, to my mind, slight tragedy, right, over the next few days and weeks, with the Hopkinses and Shirley with the other survivors, the phone calls slowed down. Telegrams and letters tapered off. Diana and Linda, their kids, returned to college, and Caroline and Warren were in the house that was empty of people. Many of the Hopkinses' friends didn't call, believing that they wanted to be alone in order to regain some emotional strength. A number of their friends later acknowledged that they hesitated because of uncertainty about how much or what to say about Caroline and Warren's terrible experience. One of the friends said, you no doubt will want privacy when you return home, and we certainly would not intrude. But as John Ziomek writes, and here comes the sort of tragedy, slight tragedy of that post-tragic event. In fact, company was exactly what Caroline and Warren wanted. That's so insightful, because you those of you out there who are not writers, you have to realize that the intimacy you had to have with Caroline and Walter to get to that point where they would tell you things like that. You hit on in the book this traumatic experience, and it's not PTSD being the most common kind of term for this now.
I think that's a really important point.
Yeah, I do too. You make it in the book.
I don't think that we were, as a society, we were thinking that often about PTSD applying to civilians in a situation like this. But I really think this crash started getting people thinking that way. And in fact, there's a psychiatrist who I quote quite a bit in the book, John Duffy, who
was very
successful at starting to get people thinking about the difficulty of surviving something like a plane crash when you don't really know anyone else on the plane except your spouse or whatever. And then there you are all alone again. And it's not like a tornado that hits a
particular
community,
right,
your street. This is a bunch of strangers who go back to their own towns. Dr. Duffy was quite influential, in my view, about getting people to bring this to the front.
Well, there's also that notion of survivor's guilt, too, that you know, I was thinking myself, if I'd been in a situation like that, where, why me? Do you know what I mean? Right. And that must have affected a number of these survivors.
Yes, absolutely. And everybody reacted differently to that. David Alexander, one of the survivors.
Right.
Then very next year, he went on the same trip that he was supposed to go on, but before everything got started, the crash happened. But he said, I've got to get past this. And he went on the same ship that he was going to be on. It was everybody on this particular Pan Am flight was going to a cruise. They obviously never made it. But he duplicated everything and actually did the cruise. The most survivor guilt of all was probably Robina Van Lanschot, who was on the KLM plane.
Yep.
Until a few minutes before it left the terminal. She was a hostess who worked for a tourism company, and she was going to be flying over to a different island and then coming right back with some tourists to the same island, to Tenerife. Mm. So she said, oh, I'll just wait here.
Yeah.
And got a friend, said, send my luggage back. Walked away, phoned her boyfriend on the island, and 10 minutes later the crash happened. She was with her boyfriend, had no idea what was happening. And there was an interview with her. She's still alive. She raised, she married her boyfriend, had three children. She had severe survivor's guilt.
I can
for
only
many,
imagine.
Many, many years.
There are so many levels to your book, Collision at Tenerife, The How and Why of the World's Worst Aviation Disaster. After the news, I'm going to ask John Ziemek, the author, to detail, which he does in the book in minute detail, to tell you exactly what happened, if you don't mind, John.
Okay.
It's such a good book on so many different levels. It's hard for me to believe that this is indeed your first book. I certainly hope it's not his last. I hope the next one is about a subject that is not as... the book is so compelling. I know it deals with a tragedy, but many, 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 many things in life are tragic, and this is one compelling and, I think, ultimately very hopeful read, too. Welcome back to After Hours with Theodore Kogan. We're talking with my old colleague at the Sun-Times, John Ziemek, who got smart and got out of the newspaper business and went on to a distinguished career at Northwestern, where he taught and mentored a bunch of people who spent all day saying, say hi to John for me, say hi to John for me. Not saying it, but texting it. His book is Collision on Tenerife, The How and Why of the World's Worst Aviation Disaster. We've been talking about it and the detail that John has been able to gather from many of the survivors, some from other aviation experts involved, some from psychiatrists. John, I'm going to ask you to detail this crash for me, please.
Okay. Well, the Spanish government, which was in control of the investigation because it was Canary Islands and that's under Spain, took them 18 months to come up with their final report. The main reason, but not the only reason, for the crash was because the KLM pilot began his takeoff before being told to begin his takeoff. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that, but I mentioned earlier I had 11 different circumstances, mistakes, oversights that all had to fall into place. That was the worst one, but there were others. I mean, and the Pan Am plane, the KLM plane and the Pan Am plane were both diverted from their original destination because that morning, a terrorist group, which was believed that the Canary Islands should be separate from Spain, set off a bomb at the airport where these two airplanes and others were supposed to land. And just to make it really complicated, there was a bomb threat phoned in to the other airport on Las Palmas, and the operator thought the terrorist on the phone used plural when he said bomb. Did he say bomb or bombs? So she passed that along to the airport manager. The bomb had, that they had set off had already gone off. They thought, we better play it safe. They closed the whole airport. All the airplanes coming in were sent over to Tenerife to wait until Las Palmas, the airport that was their original destination, opened up again. While they were waiting, the KLM pilot made a perfectly logical decision and refueled his plane, which then made the plane tens of thousands of pounds heavier, which meant it needed more runway and a faster speed to get off the ground.
God.
If that hadn't happened, they might have missed each other. If Pan Am had had waited before taxiing on the runway, they might have missed each other. There are many of these. They just had this series of coincidences that resulted in the collision. KLM almost made it off the ground. They were about 150 miles an hour and were getting ready to what they call rotate. And but that's when Pan Am suddenly was right in front of them on the runway.
And it was
through the fog.
583
people were killed. Everyone on the KLM plane was killed, and all but 54 passengers on the Pan Am plane were killed. And the cockpit crew survived on the Pan Am plane, and four of the flight attendants, they survived also. There was another part of this that I did want to mention, which is that some of the passengers were alert enough to realize they needed to get up and out and fast. There were some estimates that at least 100 people were still alive on the Pan Am plane after the collision, at least that many.
God.
But there was this phenomenon that, again, at the time there wasn't much known about it, what we now refer to as behavioral inaction or frozen fear. Set in for a lot of the people on the Pan Am plane. They never got out of their seats. They, or maybe by the time they did, they were not fast enough to be able to make it out before.
One of the things is about this tragedy is a weird thing, as John Zimek points out late in the book, that the week after the crash, hundreds of people betting in the state of Massachusetts lottery played the number 7470, apparently following the prominence of the 747 airplanes. Incredibly, that number sequence was drawn, but so many more people than usual had bet on the numbers that the parimutuel payout for a $1 bet was reduced from the usual $6,000 to $2,044. John, you can be terribly proud of this book. I know it had to be a difficult one to write, and it did take, you know, it took more than 30 years. It was not because John was lazy he had other jobs. He was a distinguished professor at Northwestern. I know the response to the book has been, certainly from people I know and from what I've read, really good. It's a hard book to promote in this weird publishing environment we were just talking about. But do you feel empowered having done this, John? It's your first book. And is it empowering because there's so much work involved in this thing?
There was a lot of work to get all the details right. But I did also want to make it very clear that there are things that people can do. I mean, being an alert passenger when you get on a plane, you know, this surveys show that about a third of us are actually a little nervous about flying, even if we've never even been in a difficult situation when we get out of a plane.
Yeah, sure.
But there are ways to reduce that. And I think just something as simple as reading the card and listening to the flight attendants can actually help reduce one's concerns about flying. Also, it creates a pathway in the brain. And should that 1 in 3 million bad thing happen, and that's about how often, that's how what it was in 2018. One flight out of every 3 million, there was something bad. If should that happen, your brain knows what it's supposed to do. It'll know where you're supposed to get. And
has this at all changed your attitude about flying?
I actually am an easy flyer. I'm not sure why, but especially after this. But no, I'm still fine with flying. Also, I am a flyer who pays attention, and I try to sort of mentally encourage my other passengers to do the same when I get on a plane.
Well, what you should do is have a pile of these books and start selling them at the entrance to the plane. It's not my place to be proud of you at all, but I'm always proud of former colleagues or newspaper guys really come through and produce something of such great value as is Collision on Tenerife, the how and why of the world's worst aviation disaster. I think John does a great job, an incredible job of detailing what went into this tragedy that need not have happened, but also the triumph of some of the people who did survive. It's a remarkable book, John. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And
it's
if you see the name Jennifer Zester, after the news, I'm going to ask John Ziemek, the author, to detail, which he does in the book in minute detail, to tell you exactly what happened, if you don't mind, John. It's such a good book on so many different levels. It's hard for me to believe that this is indeed your first book. I certainly hope it's not his last. I hope the next one is about a subject that is not as... the book is so compelling. I know it deals with a tragedy, but many, 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 many things in life are tragic, and this is one compelling and, I think, ultimately very hopeful read, too. Welcome back to After Hours with Rick Kogan. We're talking with my old colleague at the Sun-Times, John Ziemek, who got smart and got out of the newspaper business and went on to a distinguished career at Northwestern, where he taught and mentored a bunch of people who spent all day saying, say hi to John for me, say hi to John for me. Not saying it, but texting it. His book is Collision on Tenerife, the how and why of the world's worst aviation disaster. We've been talking about it and the detail that John has been able to gather from many of the survivors, some from other aviation experts involved, some from psychiatrists. John, I'm going to ask you to detail this crash for me, please.
Okay. Well, the Spanish government, which was in control of the investigation because it was Canary Islands and that's under Spain, took them 18 months to come up with their final report. The main reason, but not the only reason, for the crash was because the KLM pilot began his takeoff before being told to begin his takeoff. Now, there's a couple of reasons for that, but I mentioned earlier I had 11 different circumstances, mistakes, oversights that all had to fall into place. That was the worst one, but there were others. I mean, and the Pan Am plane, the KLM plane and the Pan Am plane were both diverted from their original destination because that morning a terrorist group, which was believed that the Canary Islands should be separate from Spain, set off a bomb at the airport where these two airplanes and others were supposed to land. And just to make it really complicated, there was a bomb threat phoned in to the other airport on Las Palmas, and the operator thought the terrorist on the phone used plural when he said bomb. Did he say bomb or bombs? So she passed that along to the airport manager. The bomb that they had set off had already gone off. They thought, we'd better play it safe. They closed the whole airport. All the airplanes coming in were sent over to Tenerife to wait until Las Palmas, the airport that was their original destination, opened up again. While they were waiting, the KLM pilot made a perfectly logical decision and refueled his plane. which then made the plane tens of thousands of pounds heavier, which meant it needed more runway and a faster speed to get off the ground.
God.
If that hadn't happened, they might have missed each other. If Pan Am had waited before taxiing on the runway, they might have missed each other. There are many of these, they're just all this series of coincidences that resulted in the collision. KLM almost made it off the ground. They were about 150 miles an hour and were getting ready to what they call rotate, but that's when Pan Am suddenly was right in front of them on the runway.
And it was
through the fog.
583
people were killed. Everyone on the KLM plane was killed. Ugh. And all but 54 passengers on the Pan Am plane were killed. And the cockpit crew survived on the Pan Am plane, and four of the flight attendants. They survived also. There was another part of this that I did want to mention, which is that some of the passengers were alert enough to realize they needed to get up and out and fast. There were some estimates that at least 100 people were still alive on the Pan Am plane after the collision, at least that many.
God.
But there was this phenomenon that, again, at the time there wasn't much known about it, what we now refer to as behavioral inaction or frozen fear, set in for a lot of the people on the Pan Am plane. They never got out of their seats. Or maybe by the time they did, they were not fast enough to be able to make it out before.
It is one of the things is about this tragedy is a weird, weird thing, as John Zimek points out late in the book, that the week after the crash, hundreds of people betting in the state of Massachusetts lottery played the number 7470, apparently following the prominence of the 747 airplanes. Incredibly, that number sequence was drawn, but so many more people than usual had bet on the numbers that the parimutuel payout for a $1 bet was reduced from the usual $6,000 to $2,044. John, you can be terribly proud of this book. I know it had to be a difficult one to write, and it did take, it took more than 30 years. It was not because John was lazy he had other jobs. He was a distinguished professor at Northwestern. I know the response to the book has been, certainly from people I know and from what I've read, really good. It's a hard book to promote in this weird publishing environment we were just talking about. But do you feel empowered having done this, John? It's your first book. And is it empowering because there's so much work involved in this thing?
There was a lot of work to get all the details right, but I did also want to make it very clear that there are things that people can do. I mean, being an alert passenger when you get on a plane. You know, this surveys show that about a third of us are actually a little nervous about flying, even if we've never even been in a difficult situation when we get on a plane.
Yeah, sure.
But there are ways to reduce that, and I think just something as simple as reading the card and listening to the flight attendants can actually help reduce one's concerns about flying. Also, it creates a pathway in the brain. And should that 1 in 3 million bad thing happen, and that's about how often, that's how what it was in 2018, one flight out of every 3 million, there was something bad. Should that happen, your brain knows what it's supposed to do. It'll know where you're supposed to get.
Has this at all changed your attitude about flying?
I actually am an easy flyer. I'm not sure why, but especially after this. But no, I'm still fine with flying. Also, I am a flyer who pays attention. And I try to sort of mentally encourage my other passengers to do the same when I get on a plane.
Well, what you should do is have a pile of these books and start selling them at the entrance at the entrance to the plane. It's not my place to be proud of you at all, but I'm always proud of former colleagues or newspaper guys that really come through and produce something of such great value as is Collision on Tenerife, the how and why of the world's worst aviation disaster. I think John does a great job, an incredible job of detailing what went into this tragedy that need not have happened, but also the triumph of some of the people who did survive. It's a remarkable book, John. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And it's if you see the here. Name Jennifer Ziemek on some kind of painting or any other kind of visual artwork, if you're in Los Angeles or in some museum someplace, buy it. John, take care. Thanks so much for coming in. Jennifer, great
much,
to see
Rick.
You too.
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll be back and we'll talk about many things, but the value of arts for children.